Laurie Gottlieb, welcome to the Last Post interviews, and thank you so much for sparing your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Laurie, you're amazing. Your book, Maybe You Should Speak to Someone, out on Scribe here in Australia, is an amazing book. You're an author, a psychotherapist, a national advice columnist, and you invite us into your world with such honesty, humour, and that then becomes with ease, whether it was meant with ease when it was written. But yeah, tell us about the book. It's an amazing book.
Yeah, so in the book, I wanted to bring people into my therapy office because I feel like what I get to see every day tells us so much about the human condition and about all of us and what we all go through in life. And so I follow the lives of four very seemingly different patients. And then there's a fifth patient in the book, and the fifth patient is me, as I go through my own therapy with my therapist. So you see the world as, from my point of view, as both clinician and patient.
Yes, it's wonderful in that regard too. And along the way, you led us into thoughts quotes and extensions of those thoughts and quotes through your own experience as a psychotherapist. I guess during the COVID lockdown, there's been a whole new, this might require another book of its own.
You know, I think that a lot of the themes, and Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, are so relevant to what's going on right now in the world in terms of how we grow in connection with others and in terms of how we're seeing that we're all more the same than we are different. And really also noticing that our emotional health matters, and it shouldn't take a crisis for us to focus on our emotional health. It's kind of like we treat our physical health differently. So if we feel some discomfort in our body, we'll go to the doctor and get it checked out before we have a massive heart attack, for example. But if we feel some discomfort emotionally, often we don't go get it checked out until we're really in crisis. And so, you know, I think that what we're learning now is that it's really important to take care of our mental health all the time, not just during a time like we're going through now.
Indeed. And one of the things, we'll lead into a lot of that stuff too, but I guess one of the things you say about the human condition and the misappropriation of emotions directed towards humans is that the three most romantic words may not be "I love you," but it may be "I understand you."
That's right. I do write that in the book. I see that with couples a lot, where what somebody really wants to know is, are they understood? And I think that that's because a lot of times we don't know how to listen to somebody else. When somebody else is talking, we're already formulating our response. We're already, formulating our defense, or we're figuring out how to fix their problem, as opposed to just hearing what they have to say. And so what people really want is that experience of, I see you, I hear you, I understand you.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And I guess, is it the hard work in changing that discourages people from looking too closely in the mirror? I know that you mentioned Becca, who kept venting about her friends to you. And then she related a story about Wade, who suggested she just change friends. Or how important is it for people to vent? Because it seems a bit of a waste of time.
Right. So one of the things that I hope the book does for people is it shows them what therapy really is and also what it isn't. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about what therapy is, and it's not about coming into vent and leaving. It's actually a lot of work, and it's really rewarding work because you have to make long-term changes in what is not working in your life. So a lot of people will come in and they say, I want things to change. But usually what they want to change is someone else or something else. And what they really need to change is their role in what's not working. And, you know, I think we all have blind spots. And one of the things that a therapist can do for you is to help you to see those. I talk in the book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. In idiot compassion, it's what our friends do for us. Somebody will say, you know, my boyfriend broke up with me, or my boss did this, and we tend to say, you know, yeah, they're terrible, and you were right, they were wrong. And that's idiot compassion. It's kind of like if a fight breaks out in every bar you're going to, maybe it's you, but we don't say that to our friends. A therapist will hold up the mirror to you and say, I want you to look at your role and what's not working.
Indeed. And I guess that idiot compassion is dangerous because, of course, the person who starts the venting is then waiting for idiot compassion.
That's right. That's right. And they feel unsupported if they don't get it. And what they don't realize is the most supportive thing that they can get is some information about maybe what is not working for them so that they can do something differently next time. Because a lot of times the things that people find problematic are patterns. It's not a one-time occurrence.
Mm, that's right. And I guess part of your work also is to get people to identify and recognize and appreciate who they really are rather than the person that they want themselves to be seen as, perhaps.
Right. Well, part of therapy is, you're right, getting to know yourself. I did a TED Talk recently where I talk about the stories that we tell ourselves and how we're all unreliable narrators and what happens when we start to revise our stories. And one thing that happens is you start to unknow yourself. And what I mean by that is you start to let go of the limiting stories that you've been telling yourself about yourself that have prevented you from living your life the way you want to live. So some people will have a story in their head that I'm unlovable, or they might have a story I can't trust anybody, or they might have a story nothing ever works out for me. And so those stories are old stories, they're faulty narratives, and it really helps people to have an opportunity to really examine the stories that they're walking around with and seeing the way that those stories limit them.
Mm-hmm. Why do people engage in negative talk? I mean, you hear it all the time in the bus, in public transport, on the radio. When people really, is it because they have nothing to say? Are they really feeling that bitched with life that they have to vent this anger or boredom, you know, like so much chit-chat?
Well, I think that we're so unkind to ourselves. You know, I always say to people when I give talks, you know, I might say to the audience, who's the person that you talk to most in the course of your life? And most people will say it's a partner or it's a parent or it's a best friend or a sibling or a mm-hmm. child. And really the person you talk to most in the course of your life is you. It's that internal voice that you walk around with. And for many of us, that internal voice is so self-critical. You know, it's the voice that says, you know, oh, you made a mistake, you're so stupid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd never say that to a friend, not because you're being nice, but because you don't actually believe that about your friend because she made one mistake. And so really, I think that we need to have more compassion for ourselves, and people don't like to hear that because they feel like, well, if I'm being compassionate with myself, then I'm not holding myself accountable. And the truth is that self-flagellation gets you nowhere. Self-flagellation does not make you feel accountable. It just makes you feel bad. Mm. Self-compassion allows you to see yourself more clearly so that you can figure out how to move forward and really hold yourself accountable as you really are and not as, you know, as being some kind of taskmaster to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed too, Laurie. And I guess everybody, as you note in the book, everybody has a story to tell, but some are fearful of telling the story because they think that it may be boring, but the boring ones are those that actually don't tell the story, don't let you in.
That's right. So many people are worried that they're going to bore their therapist. And I think people don't realize how fascinating their stories are because I think as humans, we are fascinating creatures. And so the people who bore me in therapy are the people who won't take off the mask. They're the people who go on tangent after tangent after tangent. And I'm thinking to myself, what is the significance of this story? What are they trying to tell me? Or more importantly, what are they not talking about right now that they're avoiding talking about? Because they're trying to keep me at a distance. They're not really letting me in. Mm. But if you show me the truth of who you are, I will find you fascinating.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that may explain the proliferation of small talk or chit-chat. Because a lot of people find silence hard to deal with. You speak of an episode with Wendell where there was a blessed silence, and indeed that is an achievement of some note because a lot of people feel they have to fill in that silence with anything.
Yeah, people don't know how to sit with themselves in silence, and they don't know how to sit with others in silence. And you see that when people, for example, are waiting online or they're in an elevator. And they immediately take out their phones. They can't spend the 30 seconds, you know, with themselves in their own thoughts. It's very hard for people to be silent with themselves.
Yeah, indeed. We've all noted that too, I guess. Well, a lot of us have. But you speak also too so well, Laurie, about the collective unconscious feelings of fears. And there are so many fears that are listed there, of course, of hurt, humiliation, failure, success, and the list goes on. How do we overcome those fears?
I think that what happens is once people acknowledge their fears, they become a lot less scary. So it's almost like our fear of our feelings is scarier than the feelings themselves. And so once you acknowledge what the anxiety is about, what the fear is of, it defangs it. It becomes a lot less scary for you.
Yeah, and there was a recognition of a fear, I guess, from Wendell to you regarding, of course, Wendell was your psychoanalyst that you saw after the breakup with your boyfriend. But your fear of how briefly we are alive for, I guess, and how does one make a mark in that brief time?
One of the things that I think you see a lot of in the book is this question of how do I live my life in an intentional way? And one of the patients that I'm seeing is this woman, Julie, who is a newlywed, and she comes back from her honeymoon and discovers that she has cancer. And one of the things that I learned in working with her was, you know, it shouldn't take a terminal diagnosis to really think about how to live your life in a meaningful way. And so I think it's really important to keep death on one shoulder, and I don't mean that in a morbid way or a depressing way, but I mean it in an invigorating way, that the recognition that life has 100% mortality rate, and that's not just for other people, that's really important because it helps you to say, I do have a limited time here, and so I can't just skate by, or I don't want to just skate by because I will end up, I will be at the end of my life with a lot of regret if I don't, take advantage of the fact that I have a limited time here, and that I need to recognize that when I wake up in the morning, that I don't have forever, and so how do I want to spend my time?
Is the fear of, I guess you mentioned listening to what our hearts are saying to us, telling us, is that the mental equivalent of chit-chat, because we fill in things to do, work-related maybe, that may divorce us from the fact of what our hearts are trying to tell us?
I think sometimes we don't listen to that place of knowing that we all have inside of us. So we all have this deep place of knowing, and sometimes there's so much noise that we can't hear it because the noise is what the culture says we should be doing, what our family says we should be doing, what our friends said we should be doing, what we think we should be doing, and what we should be doing is what our hearts tell us. But we don't want to listen to that because sometimes we worry about what other people might think, even though those other people are not living the one life that we have.
You go through an amazing story about your article on parenting and how parents' preoccupation with trying to make their children happy can actually hurt the children. And then, of course, people wanting you to write a book, but you decided not to on the grounds that another book on parenting would be just too cruel to the public. And then you decided to write a book on happiness, but it made you unhappy.
Yeah. So I was really going through this time of learning to be a therapist. I was a new therapist at the time. And I think you can't really do the work of a therapist without really focusing on the core of, you know, what makes us human. And so I felt like writing the parenting book or the happiness book, and I ironically said that writing the happiness book, you know, made me depressed. I called it the miserable depression inducing happiness book because it felt like it really skimmed the surface of what I was seeing in the therapy room. And I think that a lot of people think that what I do is very dark and difficult. And a lot of what happens in the therapy room, I find incredibly invigorating and inspiring and hopeful and heroic, because you see people take risks. You see people change things about their lives. You see people make transformations that they never thought possible. You see people who have so much trouble in relationship, and then all of a sudden, you know, now they've discovered sort of what has been getting in the way, and they find meaningful relationships. You see people who are, you know, feel like they can't get their career in order, and then they figure out, well, why is that? You see people who have childhood, baggage that they're carrying around, and they don't realize how much it affects them in the present. And so you help people to have better relationships with their families. And so I think the work is very inspiring. And, I think that's the dimension of therapy that I really hope to capture in the book.
It's a brilliant book. It's just such a great read. You feel like you're there with you, and it's beautiful. So I guess that obsession with, is there too much of an obsession on happiness, and does that make people unhappy as an extension of what you went through?
Yeah, that was one of the reasons why the happiness book felt like it couldn't really get to the level of what I wanted to write about in this book, because I feel like happiness as a byproduct of living your life in a meaningful way is what we all want, and the meaning and the fulfillment are what lead to happiness. But happiness as a goal in and of itself is a recipe for disaster, because happiness isn't something that you just seek out. It comes from the meaning and the fulfillment.
And I guess that is one of the things in a preoccupation, I guess, too. But if you speak of the Mary Oliver poem, the beautiful line in that poem about what is it that I intend to do, or what is it that you intend to do with your precious, wonderful life. And then as a lead on from that, I guess there's the fact that no one's going to save you, and that you have to do this yourself. It has to come from within.
That's right. I think a lot of the time we want someone to save us from whatever we're going through, and the fact of the matter is that nobody can do that. And so that's why people try to control other people, they try to manipulate other people, they try to, their expectations of other people are unrealistic, because nobody's going to make you happy. Your life can be improved by having certain people in your life, certainly. But nobody can really make you happy. Nobody can do that for you. That's an inside job. You have to do that for yourself.
Yes, very well said. And I guess also the magnificent moment in the book where Wendell, you created this image of being in jail and grabbing the bars and wanting freedom. But of course, all around was ways to get out. And that was a liberating moment. So people obviously are stuck in their own jails and prisons a lot. And you found there were no prison guards chasing you, which was a surprising thing. So that was a big moment in the book.
Yeah, I think so many of us come to therapy and we feel trapped. And I shouldn't just say people come to therapy. I think in life, when people are talking to their friends, they feel trapped by certain situations or circumstances or people. Mm. And that's not to say that there aren't difficult people out there. When I was training, one of my supervisors, my clinical supervisor, said, before diagnosing someone with depression, make sure they aren't surrounded by assholes, right? So, certainly there are difficult people out there, but then what is your response? And so my therapist said, you remind me of this cartoon, and it's of a prisoner shaking the bars, desperately trying to get out, but on the right and the left, the bars are open. So the prisoner is not actually in prison, but a lot of us feel like we're in prison, and we don't look to the right and the left, where the bars are actually open and all we need to do is walk around the bars. We would rather shake the bars and say, this is, and be the victim and say, this is somebody else's fault, when we're actually free to do something else.
Yes, and look, you speak so well about a lot of things. One of them, obviously, is the importance of human touch. So how important is touch? You spoke about hugging the UPS guy. Tell us a bit about that.
So I was working as a journalist before I became a therapist. And I had a baby, and like a lot of new parents, I really wanted to have adult conversation during the day. And so the UPS guy would come with the many deliveries that new parents need, and I would detain him with conversation because I needed to have that adult contact. And he would back away to his truck, and it got to the point where he had tiptoed to my door and gently placed the package down so that he wouldn't, I would open the door, I would hear him and then detain him with conversation. And, in the book you read about how we actually became quite friendly, and it was a really lovely story. But, I do think that we do need to connect with others. And I think especially in this moment right now, we're seeing how important that really is.
Yeah. And look, just a couple more things. Look, you speak so eloquently about, I guess, peace. And you said it does not mean to be in a place where there is no noise, trouble or hard work. It means to be in the midst of these things and still be calm in your heart. So I guess there is the rub there.
Right, and I don't think it's so much a rub, because I think that if you don't experience struggle in some way, meaning if everything is just peaceful and nothing is, and you're just sort of skating through life, you're probably not living life on a deeper, more meaningful level. Because mm-hmm. part of the human condition is that you're going to challenge yourself, you're going to take risks, you're going to go outside of your comfort zone. And if you're not doing any of those things, then you're probably living quite a boring life.
Yeah. And the essence, I guess, is to remind yourself to be brave and strong, and I guess to follow your intuitions, which is an important thing of that. Look, also the speed of want to do things quickly, and there will be less effort required, I guess. So that may be a reason why people don't show patience with themselves. And they want to feel as though they're doing a lot, when actually all they're doing is something at speed rather than doing it properly.
Yeah, this is something that came up when I was, again, doing my training, and one of my mentors said, forget the speed of light. Everybody now moves at the speed of want, meaning people just want things to happen very, very quickly.
Yep,
we don't have any patience.
Yep.
Things need to unfold sometimes, and we don't allow ourselves the space for that.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Laurie, for being part of this, and encourage people to have a read of your magnificent book. Just have a read. It takes you right into your world in a brilliant way. So thanks very much for being part of this, Laurie.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for the conversation.